Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
It just puts you in touch with the fabric of the times. You know, you can feel them through your fingers. And I did feel very close to this group and to this woman and to this world in a way that it brought Melbourne to life.
Mary Winifred Dean was an unmarried schoolteacher from suburban Melbourne who was brutally murdered in 1930. It's a crime that remains unsolved to this day. But author Gideon Hay, who spends most of his time writing about cricket for the Australian newspaper, discovered there was so much more to Mary's story than that. She preferred to be called Molly. She was an outspoken bohemian who rebelled against society's expectations for women and against her overbearing mother. And she was immortalised in more than one Australian literary classic and one very beautiful painting. Gideon joined us to tell us about the life and times of Molly Dean. Let's start with why this story. When did you become aware of this story and what makes it interesting to you?
Okay. I'll go back to Certain Missions, which I wrote a few years ago, a book about murder of a young woman called Beth Williams, the chief suspect being a chap called John Brian Kerr. I enjoyed doing that book very much, but I reached the end of it and I thought, well, it was an interesting process, but I'm not sure that the one area where I thought the book was deficient was that I didn't do sufficient justice to the humanity of the victim. There probably wasn't much of a story to tell with Beth Williams. She was only 20 when she was killed, but I did think that maybe in true crime we do get very hung up on perpetrators. We are kind of fascinated by abnormality and extremity. It would be interesting to tell a true crime story from the point of view of the victim, to talk about the life interrupted. And I sort of had at the back of my mind that I would like to find a story that enabled me to explore those kind of themes. And a couple of years ago, I was rereading My Brother Jack, George Johnson's great sort of novel of the 1920s and 30s in Melbourne. And there's a subplot in it about Johnson's alter ego, David Meredith, is befriended at a crucial point in the narrative by Sam Burlington, a painter, who has a girlfriend called Jessica Ray. They kind of introduce him to Melbourne's bohemian salons. Meredith's an aspiring journalist. And then Jessica is killed, murdered, horribly murdered, walking across a park. The finger of suspicion points at Burlington. Meredith is sort of precipitated into crisis by allegations against his friend and learns to dissemble in ways that kind of ramify throughout the rest of the Meredith trilogy. When I was reading the book, I thought, well, every event in this is meant to be based on some aspect of Johnson's own life and experience. I wonder what the factual antecedents are. So I looked at Gary Kinane's Life of Johnson, and it has a paragraph on the murder of Molly Dean. Molly Dean was the mistress of the painter Colin Coulihan. She was horribly murdered in a laneway in Eltham. It was a bit of a scandal in Melbourne at the time. The finger of suspicion pointed at Colin Coulihan briefly, however briefly. And just fingers do the walking, don't you? You get on Trove and you put the name in and you start to look at the ways in which it was reported. And I thought, boy, oh boy, this is really interesting. This is one of those very zeitgeisty crimes that kind of resonates with the society and then after a while just slips from public view or public memory. So the combination of the two interested me, both the scandal and the fact that it had been largely forgotten.
Also that as much as it's been forgotten, it's sort of been included in this classic Australian piece of literature.
It has. It's amazing. Yes. And in fact, it transpired that it had been included in several other works of fiction. Precisely because Molly moved in a kind of society of creative people, her story was sort of memorialised by a number of the members of that community. Mervyn Skipper, the Bulletin journalist, wrote an unpublished novel called A Pressman's Soul, in which Molly is incorporated as a recognisable character. Fritz Hart, the Australian conductor with whom Molly conducted an affair, he also wrote a novel, an unpublished novel in 1941, in which Molly, a recognisable Molly counterpart, features. Sue van der Kellen, who was Molly's rival in love and Coulihan's next girlfriend, also wrote an unpublished novel called Sue's Story, in which the Molly Dean story is mentioned. Lena Skipper, Mervyn's wife, was a prodigious diarist, and she kept extensive notes on the episode and her own response to Molly, which was kind of not particularly friendly. She didn't like Molly at all. Same with Betty Rowland, who was kind of a member of that artistic circle. She wrote a memoir of that group in the 1980s, and she dealt extensively with Molly's story. So there was lots around, even before you began looking for the historical records, which I found, somewhat to my surprise, turned up in great profusion.
That's amazing.
You always start these books never quite knowing what you're going to be able to recover, and particularly when you're working at two or three generations back, beyond the reach of living memory. It's very difficult to know where you're going to start, how much you're going to be able to glean, and whether, in fact, there will be enough to build a story out of. Sometimes you do end up kind of trying to build bricks out of straw, but then again, you're always constantly surprised by how much survives from that far back, both in the form of written recollections, artifacts, and the public record. And the Public Record Office, where I did a lot of the research for this book, is one of the great Melbourne institutions. Emily, I'm sure you're conscious of it. Through the efforts of legislators and archivists over the last 100 years, an amazing record of Victoria's social history has been put together. We don't know exactly what's in it because often these records have been completely untraversed. But when you go looking for them, it's just amazing what you find.
What did you find? What can you find about this girl who lived, how long ago are we talking? What year is this?
In the 1930s. Yeah.
She was only 25 years old.
She was.
What were you able to find out about
her? Well,
she was
a teacher. This was one of the things that was quite illuminating about her. She was a teacher and the education department kept fantastic records from that period. Records both sort of inbound to the education department and outbound to the individual schools. Molly's father was a teacher, so there was quite extensive records of his teaching career. Molly was a very successful and accomplished teacher, in fact.
What did she teach, Gideon?
She taught special education. Okay. She was one of the first generation of teachers who were put in to deal with the kids that fell behind the system. Mm. The dull, in fact, they were called in those wonderfully non-euphemistic styles. But that could encompass anyone from these sort of slightly retarded to people who had English as a second language. So she was a bit of a pioneer in that area. In fact, she was an award-winning teacher. She won the best primary school teacher in her particular year at Melbourne Teachers College.
Wow.
Then, of course, going to look for the records of the case itself, it had been long assumed that the police brief of evidence had gone missing. In fact, there was a writer, Eric Westbrook, who was the head of the National Gallery for many years, who aspired to do a book on Molly Dean back in the 1970s, went looking for the records and for some reason was unable to find them. And in fact, this idea that the records had either been lost or destroyed has been perpetuated down the generations. I thought, well, let's just have one last look, shall we? And it was exactly where it should have been. I don't know how they'd been missed, but they were there. Big fat police brief and lots of really great kind of verbatim transcripts of interviews with individuals who were involved. So it was there. And, of course, Trove. Doesn't Trove make
Trove is
a miracle.
I don't know what it is.
You know, I told you I like just surf it when I've got a few spare moments. Yes. I'm just like, it's the National
National
Library of Australia's digital archives, and they often will be doing, you know, people do petitions to get digitized, some newspapers digitized, and you can correct things yourself. They've got a big community of
so you can look
people.
Up old newspapers, basically.
You can digitize newspapers.
You can go and see how this was reported at the time.
I was able to do it like that.
Wow.
It's
in a way
amazing.
That, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago would have been impossible.
Yeah.
So Trove has kind of revolutionized the way in which we do this kind of research. You still, though, do have to get your hands inky. You still do have to go right through boxes. Like, for instance, I was looking for – there was a mention in the press of – an incident that had taken place across the road from Molly's house about 6 months before, where a girl had been coshed and raped in the front garden of her house. And there weren't any details. There wasn't a name. There wasn't a precise date. So I decided I had to find that. I just had to.
Mm.
So there's a record series at Public Records, which is all the inbound kind of referrals. You get a police report comes in from a police station. This is something we're investigating. It was an unnumbered series. There was like hundreds of boxes. I didn't know exactly when it was. I sort of vaguely knew, but everything was under the rubric of 1930. So I basically had to go through the entirety of 1930. It took me over a week to find it.
That sounds like
just leafing through every single bit of paper. And I tell you what, you've got a really interesting idea of what Melbourne was like in those days from just the things that people used to report to the police. You know, my daughter's tricycle's been stolen. I can't find a bottle of tomato sauce. This kind of stuff.
Yeah,
it's a period of great trust in authority and a period of great scarcity. If you lost something, you had to go and find it.
Yeah.
Or you had to take steps to do it. So, you know, it's a very labour-intensive effort to write a book like this. But I quite like that labour intensity. To me, it just puts you in touch with the fabric of the times. You know, you can feel them through your fingers.
Yeah.
And I did feel very close to this group and to this woman and to this world in a way that it brought Melbourne to life. You know, often, you know, writing about something in your own city and being able to visit the landmarks that are recognisable, being able to walk the same streetscapes, being able to kind of imagine the makeup of families and how things were taught at school and how people consume things through the newspaper, you can really find yourself kind of inhabiting the same world as these characters.
Not to mention, I'm suddenly feeling very moved by the idea of this woman who's been lost to history and her connection with you, with a modern Melbourne man who writes about cricket most of his life. And suddenly you two are connected.
We are.
In your investigation into who she was, what happened to her, how and why. Not to mention this other lady. Did you find out what happened to the lady who was closhed and raped?
I did actually. It's strange.
And what is closhed, by the way?
I didn't actually. I was hit over the head Actually, I did find out. I looked her up on Ancestry and I found that about 2 years later, she got married, she had three children, she lived in Gippsland.
She
survived the attack. Yeah.
See.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, Ancestry puts amazing things in your path as well. It is fascinating to go and find out how this incident kind of ramified in other people's lives.
So what did you find out about this woman as you were building the picture?
Okay.
I'm reading here something that says, this is in a press release about your book, The Precarious Life of a Talented Woman Without a Room of Her Own. That's so intriguing.
Yes, yes.
I mean, she's already winning awards for her work at the age of 25.
Yeah.
What does that mean, no room of her
own? Well, of course, you know, she was of that generation, sort of caught a little bit between times. It was the first generation of young women who had the opportunity to go to state high schools. Mm. Up until that stage, education kind of finished at 12, but she just squeezed in. She got the opportunity to get a decent education. She ended up going to university high school. She was very successful at university high. I went through the school magazines there. She wrote a lot. She won a lot of prizes. She clearly aspired to a literary career. She writes in a very kind of bookish fashion. She writes quite elaborate and metrically rigorous poetry. She's obviously an omnivorous reader. One of the few kind of career options open to her was to become a teacher, and her father had been a teacher, so she was in a way following in the family business, but her family was extremely conservative. Her widowed mother was, it's not unfair to say, she was obsessed with the idea of Molly leading a respectable life.
Yeah.
Matrimony, motherhood, all the conventions. She certainly ardently disapproved of the way in which Molly circulated with unsuitable men and just obviously wondered, why can't my daughter settle down and be like everybody else? But she wasn't like everybody else. She was a restless kind of soul. She was like a cat scratching her way out of a sack. And The Room of Her Own references, of course, to Virginia Woolf, who wrote A Room of Her Own in 1929 about the predicament of the creative woman who needs an independent income if she's going to create.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Molly had no independent income. She had to earn her own income. She was a bit of a misfit between worlds. You know, she came from this very conservative suburban household, but she also gravitated towards this group of writers, composers, painters, bohemians, in which she was a bit of a misfit as well because she was excluded by gender and by class from that group and regarded with some suspicion, some misgivings by those other members.
Because even though they're artistic and sort of nonconformist and all that, it was still a sexist world, wasn't it?
Oh, they weren't. Well, I mean, they fancy themselves as extremely bohemian, but it was that very conservative and rather uptight Melbourne bohemianism that talked a better game than it played.
Yeah, and women were still seen as like potentially muses, but not contemporaries.
Yeah, yeah, or caterers, frankly, or nurturers. Yeah. Certainly Molly, one of the things that people note about Molly is that whenever she moved in that circle, she wanted to sit and talk to the men.
Mm. Yeah.
She didn't want to just hang around on the periphery. She didn't want to go to the kitchen. She didn't want to be providing. She wanted to be part of the conversation. That was something that appealed to me enormously.
Reminds me of the famous Courtney Love quote where she said, you know, don't aspire to marry the rock star, aspire to be the rock star.
Yeah, yeah. She definitely. She was a good writer. She was a promising writer. She was only 25. She'd barely had the opportunity to do what she was capable of. But interestingly, she was writing a novel at the time that she died, of which only the title survives, and it's Monsters Not Men.
Wow.
And I almost called the book that. It was so good. I felt it deserves to be a title somewhere.
Wow. So was it a life of great passion? I mean, we know that we're heading toward a murder here. So was it a life of, was she in passionate relationships, violence? Yeah,
definitely. I think she was in intellectually passionate relationships.
Okay.
She loved the company of creative men who could potentially inspire her, who could be critics of her work. I think she was very serious about her work. She was a perfectionist about her poetry. One of the great things that came into my hands when I was doing this book was there was a citation on Trove about her having had published a poem in a periodical called Verse. So I went to the State Library and I got out all the volumes of Verse and I found the poem. Great. Okay, so who published it? Verse. Percival Searle and Louis Lavater. So I went looking for records of them, and they both had papers in the collections of the State Library. And in Lavater's papers, there were half a dozen letters from Molly Dean.
Oh.
In her own handwriting and in her own voice, in her own highly authentic and distinctive voice. And I felt as though I could hear her. I felt as though I was having a conversation with her, because it was a very quite serious and quite earnest, opinionated, but also quite self-deprecating and very endearing, actually, I found it. The way in which she interacted, she was clearly just full of ideas and full of inspiration and looking for some sort of direction. Very charming. You know, she would have been enormously charming to these somewhat older men.
Mm.
But I suspect that, you know, she was most charming of all to those who were serial philanderers, quite frankly, like Fritz Hart and like Colin Coulihan.
And her mother, I'm interested in the relationship with her mother. Her mother was very much trying to stifle her.
Yes.
And I heard a reference to you saying that her mother had almost been stalking her.
Well, that's right, yes.
Tell us about, she had a young man who was, she wanted Molly to maybe end up with.
In the early 1920s, a family, the Grahams, came to live with the Deans in their home. And one of the members was Adam Graham. He was 5 years Molly's senior and became very close to Ethel, and Ethel, in her way, that sort of classic meddling mother, thought, oh, you know, this would be a good man for my daughter to marry. He was a motor mechanic. A motor mechanic was never going to appeal to a woman of Molly's instincts. Ethel and Adam Graham seem to have had a rather strange and tense and slightly sort of peculiar relationship, where they may or may not have had a sexual relationship themselves, but they did pair up to pursue Molly when she went out on her own. Where Molly was concerned, her mother simply didn't understand her, but Molly was in the position of not earning quite enough money to be able to move out of home and to get that room of her own. But I think what we'd say now is Molly's mother was intellectually, emotionally, and physically abusive to her daughter. We'd recognise those symptoms now.
Mm.
In those days, it would have been looked upon simply as a parent exercising their prerogatives.
Mm.
After the break, Gideon explores the circumstances of Molly's murder. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Gideon tells us about Molly's legacy in Australian culture. But first, he takes us back to that terrible night in 1930.
I suppose we should move on to the night of her death and then try and work backwards from there.
Okay, well, the most kind of adventurous and risque bohemian set in Melbourne was centred on a group who were called the Tonalist Painters, who were kind of not quite a modernist movement, but they did have a quite elaborate philosophical approach to art. They believed that art was all about tone, not about line. So painting should be composed of sort of patches of tone rather than relying on extensive draftsmanship or composition. So Max Meldrum was its sort of intellectual guru, very peppery controversialist, but his ablest and most charismatic disciple was a man called Colin Coulihan, who was in his mid-30s, was married, had led a fairly rackety personal life to that stage. He had a son with his wife, and he had a son with another woman, a socialite, who had gone to Paris to have the child.
Wow.
This was for a long time a secret in Coulihan's own family. I think his marriage by that stage was moribund, and he was, I think he sort of flitted from one infatuation to the next, and Molly became that infatuation at the end of 1929. Their relationship lasted about a year. It seems to have ended Coulihan's marriage. I went through Coulihan's divorce papers, and it seems like Colin was caught in flagrante, perhaps not with Molly, but it was clear that he and his wife were parting. Molly, I think, was quite keen to settle down more permanently with Coulihan. She was clearly in love with him, but at the same time, it solved a lot of problems for her. You know, the potential to move into his house or come under his protection would have given her that room of her own where she could pursue her writing instincts. I think she was quite open about that idea that this romantic entanglement suited all her purposes. But Coulihan was not the kind of man to be tied down, not certainly after the end of a marriage. I think he was looking to spread his seed a bit more widely. And he fell out of love as precipitously as he fell into love. And I think by the end of 1930, it seems to me as though the relationship, at least on Coulihan's side, had kind of run its course. Although Coulihan was always loath to acknowledge that, he seems to have been one of those men who'd like to keep lots of different balls in the air, like to keep all his options open. On the night in question, Molly had received tickets to go to the theatre, the Bijou Theatre, for the showing of Pygmalion from Betty Rowland, who was unable to go. So Coulihan went with Molly, the Skippers, the Leesons, who were another sort of artistic couple, and another young man in their circle. Pygmalion is an incredibly apposite play for them to go and see, because if you know the plot of Pygmalion, it's about, you know, the woman from the wrong side of the tracks who's sort of made a plaything of by two kind of arrogant intellectuals and then kind of struggles to return to her own world. And in fact, when you read the script for Pygmalion, you think, boy, some of these lines must have echoed in both Molly's and Coulihan's ears. It must have felt as though it was all about the terms of their relationship.
How awkward.
Yeah, very awkward. She was reading Sinclair Lewis's novel Main Street, which is a fantastic novel about a young woman who leaves her marriage in order to go and explore the outside world in order to develop some kind of more exciting life than simply sitting in this gopher prairie, this kind of paradigmatic American Midwest town. So there's all sorts of things kind of bouncing around inside Molly's head, I imagine, that night. Anyway, the play ends. They walk back towards Flinders Street Station. The party disperses. Molly really wants to come to Coulihan's home. The night before, Coulihan had painted Molly a very beautiful nude, we might talk about this later, called Sleep. But on the night in question, Coulihan had said, no, you can't come over tonight, and you can't come over tomorrow night either. Wonder what all that was about. Never divulged exactly the reasons why Molly couldn't come around, but you can probably guess. Anyway, so she hops on her train. She goes to St Kilda Station. She gets out at St Kilda Station. It's just after midnight. She wants to continue a conversation that she'd had earlier with Coulihan about the idea of leaving the teaching service in order to become a full-time writer. And she may, in that gesture, have been trying to persuade Coulihan to make their relationship more permanent. She's kind of trying to push things to a brink. She's trying to give Coulihan an ultimatum, you know, tell me where I stand. Coulihan on the phone is non-committal. We only have his account of the conversation. It seems to me like Coulihan basically hung up on her the first time round. And the second time round, according to him, he said, well, don't do anything impulsive, sleep on it. In other words, he's not really interested in her problems.
So he's rebuffed her at Flinders Street Station, the central station in Melbourne. She's taken the long solo ride to St Kilda Station, however long that is in those days, 30, 40 minutes maybe, I don't know. And then when she gets there, she phones him from the station.
He's got back to his home in Hawthorne by this stage. It is sad. Yeah. It is sad. And as a result of having this conversation with Coulihan, she's missed the tram. Mm. She's missed the tram that would have taken her to her door. So she has to begin the long walk home. It's about a 25-minute walk up to Elwood. She's seen by a number of eyewitnesses, people dispersing from the theatre, people outside pubs. They seem to see her with a handkerchief to her eyes as though she's been crying. She's walking briskly but distinctively along the street under a new moon, so it's quite dark that night. The street lights of Melbourne are, of course, rather primitive in those days. She's walking into leafier and leafier confines of Melbourne. She finally turns the corner into Dickens Street. She's glimpsed out the window of a flat by a young law clerk who looks down and sees her face illuminated. And then she moves out of sight. She walks around the corner. And there, out the front of 5 Addison Street, which in those days was a Californian bungalow but is today a block of flats, she was attacked from behind with an iron bar, disabled, dragged across the road into a laneway, which is still there, horribly mutilated and violated, and left for dead. Her groans are heard by the people who live at 5 Addison Street. They call the police. The police come. She's taken away. She dies in hospital. She fights tooth and nail for her life. The doctors were amazed by the injuries that she'd suffered, that she managed to cling on to her vital spark for as long as she did. The police go to Molly's house, which is just around the corner. She wasn't far from where she lived by the time that she was killed. They wake up Ethel Dean, and her responses are very peculiar by any means. The police tell her, your daughter's met with a mishap, basically. She's had an accident. Ethel seems to understand intuitively that it's foul play. She says, have you got the man who did it? And the police are kind of surprised by this because they haven't actually told her that Molly's been attacked. They take her to the hospital. She never asks anything about what's befallen her daughter. She never asks to go and see her daughter. She's very uncomfortable about the presence of the police. She says to one of the nurses, there are those horrible men, they're going to ask me all these terrible questions. Then the next day when the police go to see her, she says, I hope you don't catch the man. And the police go, yeah. And she goes, so he will have to live with his conscience for the rest of his life, which is not by any means. I mean, there are no correct responses under circumstances of such extremity. But she was clearly undergoing something. It may have been something to do with the fact that this horrible, unrespectable thing had happened to her. What a shaming incident that her daughter should have met with foul play this way. She could also have been hiding something, and that's certainly what the police concluded. And they believed, once they looked into the slightly strange relationship that Ethel had with Adam Graham, that they had their suspects. They really had no evidence other than circumstance, other than suspicion. Adam Graham was charged with the murder at the inquest, even though neither he nor Ethel actually testified, obviously on the advice of counsel not to say anything on grounds that might incriminate them. But the case in the end didn't actually go forward. It went to the Crown Prosecutor. He said, obviously, we really don't have anything here. We can have all the suspicion that we like, but we have no actual real evidence to connect Graham and Ethel to the murder.
I wouldn't think so. In those days, obviously, the science is pretty primitive. Mm. And if nobody saw the attack, did anybody see an attacker running away? Nothing like that. You have nothing but a hunch and a weird family.
Yeah, nothing like a hunch. The context for this is that there are two other murders that take place in Melbourne at the time, either side of the Molly Dean murders. They're later, it's an 11-year-old and a 16-year-old who are both killed by what it transpires 5 years later is Arnold Soderman, the serial killer. The police can make neither head nor tail of these murders. In the case of the first murder, they pursue a man called Robert McMahon, who's a vagrant And they get it horribly, horribly wrong because he could not possibly have been there. In fact, it transpired that even though they charged Robert McMahon, he'd actually been on the road walking from Melbourne to Sydney in the way that you did in those days if you had no money. He'd stopped off in a country town and was seen by a huge variety of witnesses. Police never investigated it, but Truth newspaper did and demonstrated that McMahon could not possibly have been the killer. This is mortifying for the police. Yeah. They are never likely to pursue Adam Graham because of the risk of the case falling over as well. Mm. So it's got the police are on the back foot. The family doesn't really want to help. Molly's circle of friends, extremely embarrassed to have been caught in this scandal in Bohemia. So they are reluctant to get involved as well.
Why is it scandalous?
Because of the circle I think that Molly was moving in. She was a young, vital, talented, promiscuous woman who made up her own rules of engagement.
So did the papers pick up on that? Was there media about it?
The papers did pick up on that. They were perhaps less blaming than you might have thought.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly as far as the public was concerned, there was a strong sense that this was at the risque end of the criminal scale. I mean, in those days, crime was pretty low end, let's face it. It was confined mainly to the poor and the criminal classes. And Melbourne was a city that was very easily scandalised. It was pretty prim, pretty shockable.
So do you think it was a case of slut-shaming, as we would call it today?
I think there was an element of that, for sure. Certainly no one had a particular interest in pursuing this case any further afterwards. Molly had no natural constituency. As I said before, she was kind of caught between worlds in life. And she fell between worlds in death.
And her own family, like to think your own family isn't even that interested in advocating for you is quite shocking. And
no, it is shocking.
Mm. And that's where, again, it becomes quite moving for me that here is you, you know, she would never in her wildest dreams have ever thought that a man in the future
would care so much to do all this research.
Yeah, want to get to know her and want to get to the bottom of this story.
Yes, I liked her a lot. And she felt like a decidedly contemporary figure.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the case that Molly had caught up with the world. It was that the world had caught up with Molly. You know, we finally identify her as a kind of a type, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. She has been rediscovered in the 21st century because a young woman called Melita Rouston wrote a play about her called Solitude in Blue. She was incorporated as a character in Crystal Thornell's very nice piece of literary fiction, Night Street. She's the subject of a song, fantastic song by Lisa Miller, which she's written in the last few years. Lisa was just researching kind of the history of her suburb when she came across the Molly Dean case, and she was profoundly moved by it. So she wrote it. And there's a novel that's just come about Molly Dean by Catherine Kovacic called Portrait of Molly Dean. So she's kind of, she's in the atmosphere. I don't think it was any fluke that the story found its way to me. It was just, this has been a story waiting to be retold, and it felt like a great honour to have the opportunity to do it.
Tell us about the painting, Gideon.
Oh, yes.
The painting is an amazing story. Okay, so there's this painting. Molly was painted the night before she died. It's a beautiful painting. It's on the cover of the book. It's a nude. She's kind of folded up into a plush armchair. There's a kind of a post-coital stupor about it, if you like. The painting is called Sleep. It's never been shown in public. I knew that it existed. I'd seen one reproduction of it. So I had to find it. I had to see it. Only one photograph was ever published of Molly afterwards. It's this rather kind of nondescript, rather flat, rather granular photograph that doesn't really do her justice. So I wanted to see an image of her through the eyes of someone who knew her well, and no one could have known her better than Coulihan. So I hunted the painting down. It was acquired in the mid-1990s by a collector. It was sold by Coulihan soon after the murder. He wanted to get rid of it. He sold it for 15 guineas to a friend of his. The descendants of that friend sold the painting in the mid-1990s to a big private collector who specialised in Coulihans. So I got the address for this person from another source and I wrote them a letter. I didn't get a reply. I wrote them another letter. I didn't get a reply. I looked them up in the phone book. Well, they actually had a number. I'll ring them. Woman answers the phone. Oh, yes, got your letter. Very busy at the moment. Can't possibly talk. Ring me back in a month's time. Ring her back in a month's time. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I'm really busy. Everything's all these things happening at once. Don't have time to talk to you. Ring me back in another month. So I rang back in another month. trying to make it sort of quietly clear that I wasn't going to go away.
Yeah, no.
I was continuing to make a polite nuisance of myself. And she finally said, oh, all right, come around 1 o'clock next Tuesday. So I went around to her house, knocked on the door, and door opens. It's a nice house. It's in a well-to-do suburb. It's full of paintings. Like you've never seen a house so full of paintings, and almost all of them are Coulihan's or Turner's. This is a person. It was the widow of the collector who had inherited the collection. And I walked in and I recognised a lot of the paintings because by this stage I'd learned quite a lot about Coulihan, so I recognised his paintings. Oh, that one. It was great to see them in real life. So we walk into the living room and the woman says, oh, there's Molly. So I turn around and look at the painting and I went, wow, that's amazing. That is a great, great painting. And I really wanted to see this painting. I was really excited about seeing it. I knew it would be really good, but it was great. It looked like it had been painted yesterday. Mm. It was so alive. It was so fleshy. It was so vital, absolutely kind of oozed Molliness. And I was so dumbstruck by it that I just stood in silence for about 15 seconds and the woman said, I'll just leave you alone for a few moments. And once again, one of those great kind of eureka moments of research where you finally feel really, really close to your subject. And the collector very kindly gave me permission to use the painting on the front of the book. And it really is, it feels like the lover's gaze on Molly's beauty and personality and her forthcoming legend, if you like.
It does, but for me it's very melancholy because I know that that same lover then rejected her a day later.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like we've all had that train ride, to be honest, you know?
We're recognising a few people in this story,
absolutely.
Aren't we?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, where the man says, no, you can't come back to my house.
Yeah.
And you can't come tomorrow either.
That's right.
After 24 hours before painting this incredibly intimate portrait of
you've her. Absolutely got it, Michelle. That's exactly what is profoundly moving about this story to me. In a way, it's a kind of a minor story, isn't it? And the only reason we really know about this story is because Molly died the following night. But we can get right back into the personality of these two individuals and their two kind of star-crossed lives because of the way in which murder gives us an aperture through which to view the past.
Absolutely.
And this is what happens when you look at the victim rather than the perpetrator, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah.
And you know, you started this conversation with that beautiful phrase, a life interrupted. Is that how you said it?
Yeah.
And then here we are, however many minutes later, feeling like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Like we can see all the promise that life had.
It's a universal story, really. And then it went on happening, Michelle.
What do you mean?
Because the story's been kind of retold a number of times. I mean, I mentioned before that my brother Jack, but then Mervyn Skipper wrote his book in 1930, and then Fritz Hart wrote this amazing unpublished novel. Oh, just to explain the provenance of this, Fritz Hart, partly as a result of having been on the fringes of this murder, kind of had to move overseas. He moved to Hawaii and became the conductor of an orchestra over there. During the Second World War, he suddenly decided that he wanted to become a novelist. He wrote 23 unpublished novels. They're all in the National Library of Australia in his papers. When I found this out, when I looked at the study guide for his collection, I thought, well, you don't undergo an experience like that and then write 23 novels and not somehow mine it. So I'll bet one of those is about the Molly Dean story. So I went to the National Library. I sat in the reading room for a week going through his unpublished fiction. I got to number 17.
Of course.
And it
always
was
the way.
The one.
Yeah.
James Comes to Dinner. And it's an amazing retelling of the story because you get up very close with Molly. He evokes her character and her presence quite powerfully, her sexual allure quite powerfully. Hart's other novels are quite chaste and quite decorous. Here there's a real sexual tension between James, the painter, and the character who's based on Molly. And the other thing is that she's not murdered in this novel. She goes mad at the end of it. And in fact, over the course of the novel, having initially been presented quite sympathetically, Hart presents her with greater and greater levels of hostility and more extremes of language. He actually makes her sound like a real, well, a cock tease, if you like, to use an old-fashioned expression. it's almost as though he ends up bearing her a certain animosity, perhaps for the fact that he moved overseas after the case because he got mixed up on it and it was kind of embarrassing to him. It's a very interesting retelling of the story because you compare it to the factual record and it deviates from it in significant respects that you can kind of analyze and interpret. And fiction is never a literal transcription of fact. And often it's that gap between fiction and fact where you find where the imagination is working and how it's sort of bending real life events to the individual's will.
I would love to do that kind of research, but it's like you were a detective, essentially. You're just uncovering and uncovering and doing, really putting in the hard work, and it paid off because you've got this fabulous book. And do you love the research process as much as the writing, or the research process more than the writing?
Well, the research process for every book is kind of different and exploratory, and sometimes it doesn't work. You know, I'm here talking about the great things that I found, but you know, I can't do justice to the amount of times that I went down completely blind alleys. So the eureka moments are kind of, they happen only occasionally, but they are amazing moments. I'll tell you another one from this book. I got very interested in, there's a chapter in it about the business of being a woman, a young woman. It's called The Visible Woman, I think. And it's a period, the 1920s is a period where women are becoming visible, particularly young women. They're dressing in ways that unexampled before. They're leading lives that have not been seen before. They're having to take steps to adapt to those new mores. And one of the interesting things that was found in vicinity of Molly's body was a pessary, a kind of a form of, a sort of a diaphragm, diaphragm of its time, a kind of a form of female contraception. Interestingly, this was not written about in any of the newspaper accounts. It's in the inventory of the objects found around her body in the police records. And I thought, well, that's interesting. She's quite a venturesome woman if she's taking contraceptive precautions, if she's controlling her own fertility. So what are the implications for a young woman in those days of having to look after your own fertility? Well, here are the risks. There's venereal disease is a very real risk in those days. And, of course, abortion is unprocurable. It's illegal. It's completely taboo. And when I was going through the police records of the case, the records of the policeman who investigated it, just before the detective in question who investigated Molly, he just investigated an abortion-related death, an illegal abortion-related death of a young woman called Irene Argent. So I thought, that's interesting. I'll go and have a look at the Irene Argent inquest file at PRO. And she was a young woman who'd got herself knocked up by a railway clerk. She'd been scheduled to meet a friend at Flinders Street Station. She sent him a telegram, said, can't make it today, have to undergo an operation, will be in touch, never heard from again. Body found 6 months later. Badly, badly decomposed, unidentifiable body found in a paddock in Langwarrin. She's identified by her teeth, and what should be in the inquest file? The teeth.
Wow.
In a little paper pocket.
No.
Yeah, in a paper pocket. I took a photograph of it. It's in a scandal in Bohemia. I just thought the story was so amazing. And what it evoked about the implications of a woman who didn't take precautions was very compelling, very evocative. So it's a detour off the main story, but it's a very interesting evocation of the kind of the milieu that Molly inhabited.
Oh, and it's actually a great read from a feminist perspective. You know, to be reminded of how far we've come in such a short period of time and of the women who went before us. And the lives they led and the risks they took and how difficult it was for them to live lives that we take for granted.
The day that I walked the route that Molly took home, I did it several times.
Is similar. When you were describing it, I thought, I've done that walk many times and it's still dark and it's still a lot of overhanging sort of plants and stuff. At nighttime, it's still creepy.
The first time I did it, it was a beautiful summer's day. I walked along the streets, you know, lots of young women there, in various states of undress, looking extremely liberated. And I thought, we have come a long way, but maybe we kind of take those sort of freedoms for granted because lives were so different not that long ago.
Well, we have, and yet we know that Tracy, the sex worker on Grey Street, who was murdered 4 years ago, and it's still an unsolved crime. So, you know, in so many ways we've come a long way, and then in other ways it's still possible for a young woman to have her life taken and for us never to know how or why or by whom.
But I think in the end what for me was important was not necessarily to solve the crime. in some respects, solving a crime where the perpetrator would be dead by now is a bit pointless.
Mm.
What I really wanted to do was recover the story of the life. You know, the death got me in, but the life made me stay.
Yeah. It's a social commentary, isn't it? It's about Molly, but it's about – did you have a theory about who did it? Did you come to any conclusion?
I suspect that it might have been the same character who attacked Doris Edna Phillips, her name was, across the road. Similar kind of MO.
Yeah.
But this time he struck lethally. In those days, you know, wasn't that difficult to get away with these things?
No.
You didn't have to try too hard. The police were pretty clumsy. Their resources were pretty limited. In Melbourne at the time, it was a pretty demoralised police force in the wake of the police strike in the early 1920s. This kind of didn't really fit the way in which they solved crimes.
Well, as we were saying, unless someone saw you do it.
Precisely.
You know, it was hard to prove that you did.
Gideon Hayes' book about the life and death of Molly Dean is called A Scandal in Bohemia, and it's available now.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook.